basic workforce have been laid off over the past two decades, with 7,000 more cuts expected this year, a frightening trend that is leading to thousands fewer watchdogs exposing corruption and keeping elected officials accountable for their constituents. Although Americans want and appreciate the accurate and unbiased reporting that local journalists provide, Cantwell writes, 200 counties nationwide lack newspaper coverage of their communities, while half of all U.S. counties are down to just one, a problem that is particularly acute in the South. The report documents how giant search and social media platforms' unfair, deceptive, and abusive practices have contributed to troubling revenue losses and employment trends that are stifling local journalism. The platforms' continued practices of taking publishers' online content without proper compensation, diverting user traffic away from local news websites, and using formats like accelerated mobile pages or AMP to obtain data about local news consumers are unfair and abusive practices the Federal Trading Commission needs to enforce against, Cantwell writes. The lawmaker's report includes an image illustrating how Google's AMP and Facebook's instant articles formats harm local journalism, even as newspapers complying with content hosting requirements. As the Seattle Times reported, Cantwell recommends Congress require that Facebook and Google negotiate payment terms with local media outlets for the headlines, photos, and summaries driving a sizable amount of traffic on their sites. A move proposed or enacted in some European countries and Australia, much to the chagrin of the big tech giants. Congressional action is needed to help local news survive the global pandemic, an onslaught of unfair practices by the dominant online platforms, the report argues, echoing a watershed antitrust lawsuit filed recently against Google by the Justice Department. Local News said Cantwell needs new laws and regulations to make sure it can compete fairly and provide its true value to local communities and democracy.
The United States 2020 presidential election is set to take place in just a few days. Former Vice President Joe Biden, the Democratic Party nominee, faces off against the incumbent Republican President Donald Trump. Is this a real election? Are voters being offered anything substantive? Let's find out. I'm Richard Medhurst in the Communique. Americans are just about to go to the polls and choose their new leader. Out of a population of 320 million, it's all come down to Joe Biden versus Donald Trump. Yes, unfortunately, this is the best that the country can muster. Now, when comparing Donald Trump to Joe Biden, there's a lot to unpack here. Joe Biden has served in government for around 40 years. He was the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, senator for Delaware, and served under Barack Obama as vice president. Donald Trump, on the other hand, doesn't have that long of a record in public service. However, he is the incumbent president. We have 4 years of his tenure to go off of, and he's seeking re-election. Let's start out with their domestic policy. While Joe Biden tries to market himself as middle-class Joe and a friend of the working class, his record says otherwise. He tried multiple times during his tenure in Congress to cut Social Security.
When I argued that we should freeze federal spending, I meant Social Security as well. I meant Medicare and Medicaid. I meant veterans benefits. I meant every single solitary thing in the government. And I not only tried it once, I tried it twice, I tried it a third time, and I tried it a fourth time.
He bragged at one point about working with segregationists. Joe Biden was also an architect of the 1994 crime bill. He pushed the war on drugs, which devastated black and brown communities disproportionately all over America.
We passed a law through the leadership of Senator Thurman and myself and others, a law that says, you're caught with that, you go to jail for 5 years. You get no probation, you get nothing other than 5 years in jail. Judge doesn't have a choice.
Joe Biden's entire career has been spent catering to the fossil fuel industry, to the credit card industry, to the big banks. Remember that he was very supportive of Barack Obama's bailout for Wall Street to the tunes of billions of dollars. Meanwhile, Americans were kicked out of their homes by the millions. Joe Biden was equally a chief architect of the bankruptcy bill in 2005, which left millions of Americans without any protections just as a recession was about to hit, and made sure that students would be lumped with student debt for the rest of their lives. And all of this at the behest of the financial sector, the insurance companies, the credit card companies, the banks. Now, when it comes to Donald Trump, one of the first things that he tried to do once he got into office was repeal the Affordable Care Act and throw millions off of their health care. And then, of course, he gave huge, enormous tax cuts to the rich. Trump completely botched and fumbled the response to COVID-19. Remember, the United States has only 4% of the world's population, yet the highest number of coronavirus cases. Over 200,000 people lost their lives. How does the richest country on earth do such a thing? All of this under his watch, not to mention the corruption by his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, flying in medical equipment from China and selling it off to the highest bidder, even if they're outside the U.S., leaving doctors and nurses without PPE, without the equipment necessary to do their jobs, having to come to work dressed in trash bags. This is corruption pure and simple. And that's the thing. Both of these candidates are corrupt to the core. You could not find worse people to run a country. Moreover, Donald Trump was impeached by the House for obstruction of Congress and abuse of power. Now, given the fact that all U.S. presidents abuse their power and obstruct justice and are corrupt to their cores, that's saying something. Now, internationally speaking, when it comes to foreign policy, what did Joe Biden do? Joe Biden was a staunch supporter of the Iraq War. As a matter of fact, he was an architect of the Iraq War. He was head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He chose all 18 witnesses that would testify in regards to the invasion of Iraq. He gave George Bush all the support that he needed to invade Iraq. And then when he was vice president under Obama's tenure, they ramped it up from 2 wars in Afghanistan and Iraq to 7 wars. When it comes to mass surveillance, this was also handed over by Bush and expanded massively under Obama and Biden's watch. Joe Biden himself and John Kerry were calling up the foreign ministries all over Europe and threatening them not to accept Edward Snowden's asylum request. They canceled his passport on purpose while he was in Russia to make sure that they could smear him as working for the Russian government, even though this is not true. Now, when it comes to Donald Trump, his foreign policy has been to completely undermine international organizations. He pulled out of the World Health Organization. He pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords. He pulled out of the UN Human Rights Council. He went and pulled out of the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. And then afterwards, he went and assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, and Abu Mahdi Mohandes. And then he went and bombed Syria in April 2018 over false pretenses, an alleged gas attack in Douma that never took place. And the OPCW tried to cover this up. The Donald Trump administration also sanctioned the International Criminal Court to try and block their investigation of war crimes in Afghanistan. They went ahead and put these brutal Caesar Act sanctions on Syria that have caused its currency to go into free fall and its economy to collapse. Brutal sanctions on Iran, brutal sanctions on Venezuela trying to steal its gold, trying to enact a coup with Silvercorp, this mercenary group that was sent into Venezuela a few months ago. The coup against Bolivia that ousted Evo Morales and forced him into exile, which was orchestrated by the Organization of American States based in Washington, D.C. And of course, we can't forget the Trump administration's persecution of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, posing the gravest threat to press freedoms worldwide. And of course, when it comes to occupied Palestine, both Joe Biden and Donald Trump have participated, aided, and abetted the oppression and the genocide that is being committed against the Palestinian people by providing the Zionist occupation with billions of dollars in military aid, and Trump even going so far as to recognize Jerusalem as its capital and the occupied Syrian Golan Heights.
I am a Zionist. You don't have to be a Jew to be a Zionist.
Due to the coronavirus pandemic, early voting and voting by mail has been encouraged a lot. As a matter of fact, a record-breaking amount of Americans have already cast their ballots in the election, either by voting early or through mail-in ballots. Now, while voter turnout seems impressive, what we've seen online are countless videos of voters waiting for hours on end in enormous queues just to cast their vote. Is that the sign of a healthy democracy? That's the sign of voter suppression. In a healthy, functioning democracy, you're not supposed to take an entire day just to vote and participate in that democracy. That is actually a very concerning sign, despite what rich white liberals try to say, that this is some mark of resilience, that, oh, look, people are so dedicated to ousting Donald Trump and getting Joe Biden into office that they're willing to wait all day. They shouldn't have to, if America is really a democracy, as we keep on hearing. Why is it particularly the case with voters of color in black and brown communities? People have to wait substantially longer to be able to cast their votes. Why is that the case? Why are less resources invested in those communities? Fewer polling stations, fewer volunteers and personnel. Why are there fewer voting machines? You can't be a democracy when you leave out people of color and prevent them from participating in the elections, in the democratic process. That is voter suppression, pure and simple. Not to mention, we have countless examples of hundreds of polling stations being closed down in Georgia, in Texas, and in a number of other states, preventing people from being able to vote. They might have to work. They might have to drive another hour just to get to a polling station, making it completely inconvenient for anyone who is even contemplating to participate in this democracy. We've had hundreds of thousands of people purged from the voter rolls, the vast majority of them people of color. What does that indicate? What does that say about this country and its so-called democracy? You know, if the United States took all this manpower, took all the resources that it invests in bombing other countries, in colonizing other countries, in occupying other countries, and invested those same resources and manpower and energy and time into its own country, into its own elections, I think it would fare much better. To explore this topic further, I spoke earlier with journalist and political activist Fiorella Isabella. How would you describe the current state of affairs regarding election integrity? Would you describe the election process as fair in the United States?
I'm laughing, Richard, because it's anything but fair. It's a joke. It's a sham. It's absolutely disastrous. And it is a bipartisan practice, meaning both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party cheat. In 2016, they rigged the elections against Bernie Sanders the first time. 2020, we got to follow it up. We literally interviewed poll workers before the election here, and they were telling us the machines were faulty. They were telling us that the training they got was a day's worth of training. The manuals were out of date. The voter rolls were out of date. They also found out, we also found out, that these machines have actual access to the internet, and they also have access to SIM cards. So anybody could hack that if you have the code. And we interviewed several election integrity activists and election integrity specialists that showed us exactly how easy it is if you write a code to change those numbers on these machines, because they are all owned by proprietary software, meaning they are private corporations that you know nothing about. So no, the state of our elections is entirely corrupt. And what's happening, unfortunately, right now is that it's still taboo to talk about election issues, right? Like, they still, if you talk about election fraud or say that something is rigged, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist, oh, you must be working for Putin. They love to say that Russia interferes in our elections, that some foreign agent interferes right in our elections, but they can't for one second even begin to think that we couldn't be interfering in our own elections.
Would you agree that voter suppression is rampant and that it specifically affects voters of color?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and this is, again, it's a bipartisan practice, because in the primaries, the Democrats tend to do that to the people of color. So, for instance, the night before it was the official election day primary, we went to a voting center where it was full of Latino people. It was in East LA. It was full of young people, Latino people, and people of color in general. So the people operating this polling center were giving out provisional ballots. Provisional ballots are this type of pink ballot that needs to be verified multiple times in order to even be counted, and it may never be counted. In fact, most of the time, it's not counted, and it's called a placebo ballot for a lot of people, and that was coined by Greg Palast because it's a fake ballot. Like, it's not the same thing as a real ballot. And so they were giving these ballots to people because the machines weren't working. So instead of saying, you know what, you should go somewhere else, or we could give you find a way to give you an actual ballot, they just started telling people, this is the same thing, it doesn't matter. And it's not. And so when we started going into the offices and looking at the names that were in these pink ballots, it was all foreign names, all the vast majority Latino names, which of course the Latinos heavily favored the more progressive candidate because of his immigration policy. So that it was just like obvious. And then college campuses where college students go, oh, you got three machines for a college campus of like thousands of people. I mean, that's in California. That's like Democratic supermajority California that this happened. So imagine what happens when Republicans also do the same thing in states like Florida, when they gerrymander and when they're like, no, you have to bring this and put people off the voter rolls. It's a bipartisan practice.
Many progressives who supported Bernie Sanders' campaign have suddenly switched to supporting Joe Biden. They do this in two ways. One, by pushing this narrative, this myth about the lesser of two evils, and simultaneously, by whitewashing Joe Biden's record. This is insulting to everybody who has suffered because of Joe Biden's policies domestically, because of the crime bill, because of mass incarceration, to everybody who suffered because of his war hawk foreign policy, the destruction of Iraq, the millions of people killed and displaced. This is an insult to all of us. You know, we keep hearing this idea of the lesser of two evils, that Joe Biden is somehow the lesser of two evils. To whom? To whom exactly is he the lesser of two evils? To white crypto neoliberals? To black people in America? To people of color in America? He's not the lesser of two evils. He jailed them en masse. To people in the Middle East, to Arabs, to people in Iran, to people all over the global south. This concept does not exist. We are still going to keep getting bombed. We're going to keep getting sanctioned. We're going to keep being killed. We're going to keep being oppressed and colonized, no matter who takes office. And yet we keep hearing this myth about the lesser of two evils. That is such a privileged thing to say that could only emanate from upper middle class white liberals in the United States. To further explore this topic, I spoke earlier with Nico House, broadcast journalist and campaign surrogate for Tulsi Gabbard. We all know that Donald Trump is a racist, he's a loudmouth. Tell me about Joe Biden's record, about his criminal justice, about working with segregationists, about writing the 94 crime bill.
Well, we all should know that Joe Biden is a racist and is also kind of a loudmouth as well. Like, he argued on the Senate floor that he didn't want his kids to go to grow up in a racial jungle, trying to protect segregation on behalf of Republican segregationists. The 94 crime bill is, in my opinion, far more damaging than the average person could possibly know. You can read that bill and tell this was specifically geared to put black people in jail and to basically to auction black lives out to the highest bidder via the private prison system, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, if you learn your history about that situation, it's super weird how it's in lockstep with the corruption of the DEA and the ATF. And there were lawsuits regarding that. And then, of course, Clinton fired all the U.S. attorney generals who weren't loyal to him and all the federal judges that weren't loyal to him and put his own people into the point where we didn't get them out until Trump took over. And so if you actually look at it, it looks like it was a coordinated effort, because it was. As far as Trump is concerned, this is the main difference, in my opinion, between Trump and Joe Biden. People say that those who are okay with another 4 years of Donald Trump are accelerationists, but it's actually the opposite. It's those who are okay with another 4 years of neoliberal Bidenism that is going to end up becoming accelerationists in foreign policy, domestic policy, et cetera, corruption in general, because we just saw how the New York Post was, their article about Hunter Biden was just banned before they even had a chance to confirm or deny anything. It was banned. So basically what I'm being told is that I'm allowed to fight one type of fascism, the neo-fascism, but I am not allowed to fight or critique the civility fascist that is Joe Biden.
You know, me as a Syrian, as an Arab, I know that this concept of lesser of two evils is complete nonsense. You know, no matter who gets elected, they're going to keep bombing us, they're going to keep killing us, they're going to keep sanctioning us. So, I mean, you as a black man in America, how do you feel about this myth of lesser of two evils?
You know, they don't keep bombing us, but they do keep, you know, shooting us without accountability. Look at what happened with Breonna Taylor. They don't sanction us like they do maybe Syria, but it is very similar. The banks are still racist. The last case of redlining happened in 2015. This is a Jim Crow policy in 2015. So that's still happening. Ice Cube can't even say that both sides of the establishment are screwing over black Americans. Joe Biden and Donald Trump are equally as bad. The Democratic and Republican parties are equally as bad for us. And we cannot give our vote to anyone anymore without getting something in return. And that is what they were really upset about, is that Ice Cube was doing what a lot of us independent-minded black Americans are doing, which is demanding something for our vote for once in the last 50 to 60 years.
You know, I want to ask you also about Bernie Sanders, about AOC, about the Squad. They all ran on these progressive policies, Medicare for All, Green New Deal, and yet they're telling people to vote for Joe Biden now. What does that say about them? Do you feel that they've been putting their party first, party over policy?
And it's funny because I said yesterday when I saw AOC's comments that she's not just voting for Joe Biden, but she's proudly voting for him. You can't lose my respect. And saying that you're proudly voting for a segregationist, that you're proudly voting for a sex pest, that you are proudly voting for a man who passed the 94 crime bill, obviously was one of the senators that led the way on the Telecommunications Act of 1996, the same man who authored the Patriot Act and brags about how the Patriot Act was his idea, which, by the way, had to work with Kavanaugh to get all the illegal stuff basically circumvented. Like, he went to Kavanaugh to get that squared away, in case anybody was curious. The same man who was anti-LGBTQ until it was convenient for him. The same man who fired the prosecutor in the Ukraine because the prosecutor, or got the prosecutor fired, threatened to hold $1 billion from the Ukrainian government if they did not fire that prosecutor, because that prosecutor was going to investigate Hunter Biden and his influence on Burisma. And then, of course, has just vehemently denied that. I mean, look at all the information that's coming out with Joe Biden. You can proudly vote for him. Or in Bernie's case, oh, not only is he proudly voting for him, but that's his friend. Which, by the way, I hate to say this, but I feel like it should be said. There had to be some very, very latent truth about Hillary's grievances against Bernie as far as saying that he is at least a little sexist in his approach. And unfortunately, the progressive movement has also proven to be the same, because the amount of anger and animosity that I see and I saw, even from Bernie, when he endorsed Hillary, he didn't like her. It was very clear he didn't like her. But with Biden, it's my friend. He was, in the beginning, before Biden started, you know, just trashing him and socialism, he was even enthusiastic about his support for Biden, which we can't really say about his support for Hillary. And you do got to wonder, what's the difference? Their corruption levels are about the same, except for I would say that Biden's level of corruption is almost more explicit to a certain degree, or in all the qualities and characteristics that Bernie always assigns to Trump are even more so true, not only in rhetoric, but in policy when it comes to Biden. So what's the difference there? And the only difference that you could think of is really Hillary Clinton's a woman.
You look at also the Obama years, when Joe Biden was vice president, you had the Black Lives Matter movement starting out and Occupy Wall Street starting out. So how do we reconcile that? Like, how are we supposed to believe that if Joe Biden is elected, everything is going to somehow magically become better?
Like I said earlier, man, I think it'll, you know, the fusion centers, like I was talking about, that's when the local government and police departments work with the NSA and the CIA to target and track activists. Like, a gross overstep of civil liberties. And this is what we're seeing, or what we saw under Obama. The only difference between then and now is that the protests seem to be more widespread. People seem to be more open to the realities of what fascism looks like. And they're willing to challenge it, because fascism finally has that ugly caricature of a face that is Donald Trump. But under Biden, celebrities have been tweeting it out, bro. They've been saying they're ready to stop having to tweet about politics and stop having to pay attention to politics every day. They've been saying. So we know what's going to happen. And while, meanwhile, people like myself and the black community, people like you and your relatives and your friends are going to have to just watch bombs drop again in silence.
They're pushing a candidate who does not even support their policies. He does not support universal health care. He does not support a Green New Deal. He does not support any of the progressive platform that Bernie Sanders ran on. Joe Biden is a candidate who cannot even speak properly, who has visible and very concerning signs of cognitive decline.
What kind of country are we going to be? Four more years of George, going to find ourselves in a position where if Trump gets elected, we're going to be in a different world.
This shows you how corrupt the Democratic Party is, that they're willing to put forward someone like Joe Biden, who is a right-winger through and through, who cannot even speak properly anymore. And it also shows you how pathetic the progressive wing of the Democratic Party is as well, if they're just willing to roll over and get behind a candidate like Joe Biden. They have become so brazen with this that they're not even trying to hide it anymore. Remember, at the Democratic National Convention, they even invited Colin Powell to speak. Yes, the same Colin Powell who lied to the UN Security Council about weapons of mass destruction that did not exist in Iraq. This attempt to rehabilitate neoconservatives from the Bush era, the fact that Democrats are trying to court George Bush's endorsement, that you have the Lincoln Project, Dick Cheney's daughter, Bill Kristol, Rick Wilson, all getting together to support Joe Biden, this band of disgusting war criminals and neocons speaks volumes. It tells you everything you need to know. There's no such thing as the lesser of two evils. They are the same evil. No matter who you elect, you are going to end up with the same result. And this is a reality that a lot of people just don't want to face. They need to buy into this myth that their elections matter, that America is exceptional, that they have a real democracy, despite all of the evidence to the contrary. United States elections are a farce. They are designed to pacify the population and make them believe that they have a choice, to distract them from the real power structure, from the real actors that are running the show, the intelligence agencies, and Wall Street. The United States constantly talks about democracy, but they don't even have democracy at home. This is a system that is corrupt, unjust, undemocratic, and favors the rich. Donald Trump and Joe Biden are two sides of the same coin. No matter who wins on November 3rd, black people are still going to get shot, Arabs are still going to be bombed, natives will still be without their land, workers will still be exploited, corporations will be still running the show, the colonization and imperialism and oppression of the global South will continue. In Joe Biden's own words, nothing will fundamentally change. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communicator.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Donald Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor Jared Kushner bragged about Trump getting the country back from the doctors in an April interview with journalist Bob Woodward, a report says. The senior White House advisor boasted that the president was ignoring scientists and medical experts as the coronavirus pandemic unfolded, according to audio obtained by CNN. In a taped interview with the famed journalist on April 18, Kushner claimed U.S. was moving past the panic phase and pain phase of the pandemic and was at the beginning of the comeback phase. That doesn't mean there is not still a lot of pain, and there won't be pain for a while. But that basically was. We've now put out rules to get back to work, said Kushner. Trump's now back in charge. It's not the doctors. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Kenny Stansel Ryder. This article is published under the heading, As COVID-19 Soars Ahead of Election, Tapes Reveal Kushner Bragging About How Trump Wrestled Response Back from Doctors. Here's the details. As COVID-19 infection rates across the United States of America break records less than a week before the election day, newly released tape reveal how U.S. President Donald Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor Jared Kushner privately bragged in mid-April that the president had successfully undermined the public health officials advising him on the unfolding coronavirus pandemic by committing to reopen the economy despite expert warnings. Trump is getting the country back from the doctors, Kushner boasted to journalist Bob Woodward in an April 18 interview, the audio which was obtained by CNN and released on Wednesday, October 28. At the time, the national caseload was growing by roughly 30,000 per day, while more than 40,000 Americans had already died from COVID-19. As CNN noted on Wednesday, October 28, Kushner's comments from 6 months ago look particularly damning as the U.S. undergoes a fall surge of infections. According to an Axios analysis of COVID-19 data, new coronavirus infections in the U.S. have soared to an all-time high just days ahead of November 3rd. The increase in cases has been accompanied by a rise in the U.S. pandemic death toll, which passed 227,000 on Thursday, October 29th. On average, Axios reported nearly 72,000 people tested positive for the coronavirus every day over the past week. The U.S. set a new record for the most cases in a single day twice in the past week, on its way to the highest seven-day average on record. In mid-April, Kushner told Woodward, "There were three phases. There is the panic phase, the pain phase, and then the comeback phase. I do believe that the last night symbolized kind of the beginning of the comeback phase. That doesn't mean there is not still a lot of pain, and there won't be pain for a while, but that basically was, we've now put out rules to get back to work. Trump's now back in charge. It's not the doctors. We have a negotiated settlement." Dr. Anthony Fauci acknowledged that there had been a pivot away from completely focusing on public health issues to looking at opening up the country with regard to the economy. "I don't know exactly the timing," the nation's top infectious disease expert and member of the White House Coronavirus Task Force told CNBC, "but it was clear some months ago." Kushner's statement, which critics say confirms that the Trump administration insisted on reopening the economy regardless of the advice offered by health experts and the deadly havoc it would wreak on the public because they thought it was politically beneficial, received widespread condemnation. "We know their handling the pandemic was dictated by politics, and that's a big part of the reason it was such an unmitigated disaster," wrote Washington Post columnist Paul Waldman on Wednesday, October 28. "But even more infuriating is that it was dictated by bad politics. They could have done the right thing for the wrong reasons, taken steps that would save lives solely to benefit President Trump's re-election campaign," Waldman added. "Instead, they did the wrong thing for the wrong reasons. They minimized the pandemic and undermined efforts to contain it because they thought doing so would be a political goldmine." on social media, epidemiologist Eric Figelding said on Thursday, October 28, that Kushner can go to hell for this comment. If we continue our current behavior, CNN medical analyst Dr. Jonathan Rainer said, by the time we start to go down the other side of the curve, 500,000 people will be dead.
As one of the world's most talented and prolific strikers playing for Manchester United, Marcus Rashford is no stranger to hardship in spite of his recent success. Having grown up in a single-parent family in one of the poorest parts of Manchester, Rashford himself knows what it's like to go hungry, hence why his passionate plea to feed Britain's children recently earned him an MBE.
People have opinions, whether or not they understand fully what the families are going through. It's another conversation, but because of that, it's easy for me to sort of dismiss a lot of the people that are making their opinions, because you know, I know for sure that a lot of them speak in the way that they're speaking. It's so insensitive about the issue, and they've definitely not been through it themselves. So for me, it's, you know, I'll take that all day long as we start to see improvements going forward for the people that are in need of it.
However, in spite of his ongoing campaign and recent effort to convince the UK government to continue to feed the UK's poorest children during the half-term school holidays, it seems that Marcus Rashford has been left in despair as Tory MPs have voted against his idea. The government rejection has been confirmed and approved by Boris Johnson, who has ratified the vote, stating that he refuses to move on free meals for children during the half-term period, in spite of growing pressure from the public for the PM to meet Rashford face-to-face. Although the UK really doesn't care to admit it, the introduction of the so-called tier system lockdown is essentially a national lockdown in disguise, and it's during this challenging time, with parents out of work and schools closed, that there's currently one-fifth of the UK children going hungry right now. Yet when one looks deeper at the figures in the UK, the situation appears to be really dire, with 15 million people in Britain living in poverty, which equates to around 22% of the population. Of these, 5 million of them are children, showing that the UK, as a supposedly developed nation, has deep secrets that it should not be proud of. Add to this the situation that for many school children in the UK, due to the extreme poverty, abusive parents, lack of social care, and a failing government, for many kids the only meal of the day comes from school. This also comes on top of the introduction of uniform washing facilities in certain schools, as such luxuries for some are only in fairy tales, which for the UK appears to have no happy ending in sight. When Boris Johnson won the election in the UK with a huge majority over then Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, the following honeymoon period saw Johnson gain huge popularity across the UK, in part helped by the wave of former Labour supporters who turned to the Tories over the notion of Brexit. But skip forward to today, and the people of Britain who voted for Johnson, namely the working class Northerners, are now being abandoned by the government, who are failing their children, as well as the people, when it comes to job security and the handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. In fact, when one breaks down the failures by Johnson, all of them have an adversely high effect on the poorest populations of the country. As mentioned, there are children going hungry. The handling of the Brexit negotiations, which are likely to see the UK come crashing out of the EU with no deal, and the terrible handling of the pandemic, which has seen the NHS collapse, testing fail, a death rate in excess of 45,000 people, and around 100,000 people per day newly infected. Yet in spite of all this, Boris Johnson's able to find himself in front of the cameras, claiming that he will not let the British people suffer, or the children go hungry.
Well, let's be absolutely clear. We're going to make sure that we have no children, no kids, no pupils in our country who go hungry this winter, certainly not as a result of any government inattention. We're focusing on that, as we have done very, very hard over the last few months. And we've given, you know, huge sums to local councils to help them out, but also specific sums for helping with meals during what was a very disrupted period.
Yet with Britain clearly becoming the laughing stock of Europe, it seems that the only way to judge the Conservative government of Boris Johnson is through humour, which, as seen in this picture, shows Johnson's front bench openly mocking the situation British children find themselves in. The point, however, that Johnson should be most worried about is, why did it take a Manchester United football player to raise the issue that children are going hungry? Surely this should have been the job of the UK government. And as Marcus Rashford continues to fire on all cylinders, it seems that Boris Johnson is missing the target.
The French president has faced a huge backlash in his views against Islam. Emmanuel Macron's comments on the denunciation of Islam and in defense of secularism have drawn widespread backlash from Muslim activists and advocates of the noble religion. Iran's foreign minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has denounced France's stance on insults to Muslims and their sanctities, saying such moves are opportunistic abuse of freedom of speech that would only fuel extremism. Zarif also added that Muslims are the primary victims of the cult of hatred that has been empowered by colonial regimes. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, also advised the French president to read more history and not to rejoice in the support of a declining America and Zionism.
I mean, it's quite clear, like we know that, like everybody knows the history of what France did in Algeria, okay? They occupied that place for 200 years, humiliating, mass murdering, massacres, you know, breaching Islamic laws, and disrespecting the Muslims as a whole. And they've also, you know, done a lot of colonial projects inside France in different areas.
Iran has also summoned the French chargé d'affaires to protest the anti-Muslim comments by the country's president. Meanwhile, Muslims have attended protests in Bangladesh, Iraq, Palestine, Pakistan, and many other countries, calling for a boycott of French goods. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has criticized Macron, saying the French leader needed mental checks over his attitude towards Islam. A boycott of French products is already underway in supermarkets in the Persian Gulf kingdoms of Qatar and Kuwait. It's also been demanded in Jordan and Turkey. Macron has unveiled a plan to defend France's secular values against what he labeled as Islamist radicalism. He's also claimed that the religion was in crisis all over the world. Macron has underlined that no concessions would be made in a new drive to eliminate religion from education and the public sector in the country. The French president also said his government would present a bill in December that would strengthen the country's law that officially separated religion and state. Macron's plans also include restricting funds that Muslim communities receive from abroad, supposedly limiting foreign influence.
As he sees these cartoons and these despicable pictures defaming and disrespecting a highly important figure for Muslims, one of the most highest figures, the Prophet Muhammad, and with no regards to these people's feelings. So, we're talking about French Muslim citizens, and we're talking about the Muslims in the world. We're talking about 1.9 billion Muslims that are affected by this.
Macron's comments came less than a month after Muslim protesters censured Charlie Hebdo, a French weekly satirical magazine, for its recent reprinting of blasphemous caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. A second event, the killing of teacher Samuel Paty, who had shown the blasphemous cartoons in his class, has led to further upset. While Muslims condemned the gruesome killing, the response from French officials had been perceived as linking Islam with terrorism. There are also fears of collective punishment.
I mean, it's not in the interest of France because they have a majority of Muslims compared to the whole West. I mean, they have the biggest population of Muslims in the Western world.
It's believed Macron needs to fight systemic racism in his country and provide opportunities for Muslims who have been radicalized at the margins of French society. It's also been suggested that Macron's secularist push is partly efforts to gain votes in the upcoming elections. The rise of far-right ideology and the propagation of anti-immigration policies have exacerbated the status of religious minorities in France.
A knife-wielding assailant terrorized France on Thursday. The 21-year-old man brutally stabbed several people to death at the Notre Dame Basilica in Nice. The horrendous stabbing had echoes of another attack earlier this month in the capital, in which a teacher was beheaded after having shown pupils cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. French President Emmanuel Macron was quick on Thursday to denounce the attack in Nice as an act of, quote, Islamist terrorism. The deadly knife attack comes as France is mired in an escalating row with Muslim nations over Macron's highly controversial approach towards Islam and Muslims in France. The row has been fueled by Macron's defense of cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad, which Muslims consider blasphemous. The French president says free speech and secular values are his red lines. He has pledged to push ahead with his plan to combat, quote, Islamist separatism. The French president insists that Islam is in crisis all over the world and that radical Muslim positions are hardening. Muslim leaders and scholars have condemned terrorist attacks in France, but have warned that provocative comments by Macron are fueling hatred and extremism. Muslims argue that a line must be drawn between free speech and insult to religions. Meanwhile, the United Nations warned on Thursday that insulting religions provokes violent extremism, leading to fragmentation of the society. But Macron is not listening at all. Why is he refusing to see that his deeply divisive statements are somehow destroying what's left of tolerance in the French society? The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, called the French president's defense of the blasphemous cartoons a stupid act. The leader said French people should ask their president why he supports insulting God's messenger in the name of freedom of expression. Iran's foreign minister Mohammad Javad Zarif condemned the terrorist attack in Nice. Zarif said hate speech, provocations and violence must be replaced by reason and sanity. Meanwhile, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who has been outspoken in his condemnation of Macron, says Western countries attacking Islam want to relaunch the Crusades. Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan urged Muslim leaders this week to act collectively to counter growing Islamophobia in non-Muslim states. Anti-France sentiments are running high in Muslim countries around the globe. There have been protests in many Muslim countries, including Indonesia, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, and Libya, which drew hundreds of thousands of demonstrators. Traders and people in many countries are boycotting French goods in response to France's anti-Islam campaign. Politicians in Europe have, however, been reluctant to acknowledge that radical statements and stances by top European officials are fueling the flames of extremism. Many European leaders have rallied around Macron and criticized attacks on him. The ongoing tensions may abate in the coming days or weeks, but they are likely to rise again in the future if politicians and top officials fail to respect religions and listen to reason.
Thank you.
The United States have quite simply failed when it comes to their maximum pressure and foreign policies when it comes to Iran, having essentially failed to destabilize or demotivate the people of the country. So much so that some reports state that sanctions have only achieved 3.4% of the effect that they were intended to have on the country and its institutions. It's hence why the US National Security Advisor, Robert O'Brien, has claimed that there are few new sanctions left to impose on Tehran, as it appears that all options have run out for the Americans, who have no tactics left on the table when it comes to their attempts to bully Iran into following a so-called American line of democracy. O'Brien also included Russia in his speech, stating that the number of sanctions placed on both nations have exceeded the policy strategies plans left for the nation. With the option of heading into a conflict highly unlikely, both Russia and Iran have shown that weak US policies are starting to fail as emerging powers breeze through the conditions imposed on them by the Americans. The US has also announced that both Russia and Iran, as well as China, have all played a part in trying to influence the outcome of the upcoming US elections, something that all three nations have waved off as nonsense, with Iran stating that it has no need to interfere with any nation's internal affairs, raising the question as to where the US claims such allegations might come from. Currently around the world, the US has imposed sanctions on 30 different states, ranging from West Asia, with the likes of Iran, Yemen, and Syria, to the Far East, with North Korea being a prime target. But with sanctions clearly being deemed to be ineffective, why then does the US continue to insist that it places futile sanctions on global nations around the world?
It's very interesting how the United States continues to do, even from their point of view, ineffective tactics. We've seen this in relation with Cuba, where for more than 60 years until President Obama decided to try a different tactic, there was a completely ineffective, from their point of view, blockade on Cuba, and they continue to do it and continue to do it to today. It's like they have nothing else to do but to create destruction and hardship for people, hoping that somehow this failed policy will work.
Once bitten, twice shy. It's one of the world's oldest proverbs and clearly demonstrates the amount of trust the Iranians currently give the Americans, as on multiple occasions throughout recent history, the US has shown that treaties, agreements and accords are worth nothing more than the paper they're written on, as the US pull out at will when it suits them. So why then would Iran want to enter talks with such a nation? The rhetoric coming out of Washington is interesting when it comes to Iran, with both the Republicans and the Democrats apparently both agreeing that sanctions are the preferred option when it comes to dealing with Iran. Although, with the sanctions clearly not working, what other options are available to the next US president?
Biden has said that he would continue basically the Obama approach, that he would renegotiate with Iran and find ways of reinstituting the former agreement that Trump withdrew from unilaterally. And also the other thing that Biden has said is that he would make sure that whatever sanctions were in place would not impact Iran's ability to deal with the COVID crisis.
For Trump, the notion that Biden might be the next president is something that he clearly fears, and hence why he's seeking to place even further pressure on Iran in a way that could be harder to reverse if Biden does win the White House. For Biden, however, he claims that there's a smarter way to be tough on Iran, although there have been rumors that Biden would consider re-entering the JCPOA, something that could in fact see a lifting of sanctions against Iran and paving the way for sensible diplomacy. But at the end of the day, the rhetoric on Iran by both candidates is something that still remains a pre-election talking point aimed at gaining votes. The true answer to what happens next will come to light at the end of January next year, when a new or incumbent president takes his oath in Washington.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen for giving us the opportunity to gather around the beacon of hope and guidance that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has blessed us with, which is, of course, the teachings of the Holy Quran and the words and instructions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And a lot of our narrations tell us, even the verses of the Quran tell us, that praying to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala shouldn't necessarily be something that we only do during times of distress. It should be our default. It should be our part of our personality and life, in a sense. Let's listen to a short story about the power of prayer and the importance of praying for each other. And we're going to be right back.
Today's story entitled The Ship of Friendship. A voyaging ship was wrecked during a storm at sea, and only two of the men on it were able to swim to a small desert-like island. The two survivors, who have been good friends, not knowing what else to do, agreed that they had no other recourse but to pray to God. However, to find out whose prayer was more powerful, they agreed to divide the territory between them and stay on opposite sides of the island. The first thing they prayed for was food. The next morning, the first man saw a fruit-bearing tree on his side of the land, and he was able to eat its fruit. The other man's parcel of land remained barren. After a week, the first man was lonely and he decided to pray for a wife. The next day, another ship was wrecked and the only survivor was a woman who swam to his side of the land. On the other side of the island, there was nothing. Soon the first man prayed for a house, clothes, more food. The next day, like magic, all of these were given to him. However, the second man still had nothing. Finally, the first man prayed for a ship.